Oh, all right, thank you. All right, this meeting is called to order. This is the June meeting of the Health Commission for San Luis Obispo County. Our first order of business today is approval of the minutes of the May 14th meeting. Are there any corrections or changes to those minutes that we have all received? There being no changes or corrections, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
I so move.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
All right, the minutes are approved as published. Okay, next is public comment. Anyone wanting to make a comment may come forward. You have 3 minutes. Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Johnson. I live in San Luis Obispo. I'd like to thank the Commission this month for updating their website, which now includes all 3 GMO task force reports. Having all 3 available to the public more accurately reflects last year's decision and is a better educational tool than the single industry-produced report that came from your own task force. Thank you. That said, it is possible to make a good case that the Health Commission's GMO task force report should be completely deleted because of the chair's conflict of interest. Her brother-in-law runs a family-owned diverse ag corporation that has grown GMOs. Her brother-in-law and father-in-law were both presidents of Farm Credit West, then on a board of directors that includes industrial ag people in this county. The chair has definitely acted to protect both her own economic interests and the interests of Farm Credit West in her role. This is the type of case that County Council Warren Jensen suggested when he talked about conflict of interest rules. When the conflict of interest is as large as this, the law does not allow a person to participate. Private citizens like myself should not have to investigate public figures. I wish I had counted the times the chair said fair, balanced, objective in response to questions. We can see now the reality was the opposite, unfair, unbalanced, and very subjective. Chairwoman Enns, at every opportunity in the last 2 years, you've refused to disclose your large conflicts of interest on GMOs and ag. You have intentionally inserted lies in the public record. You've formed strategies with the vice chair to keep public from commenting on an issue we care about. You protected other committee members with conflicts of interest. You violated the Brown Act and, in general, created an aura of acceptance for unethical behavior in the Health Commission. Won't you please step down? A new year is beginning, and all of us want a healthy commission we can trust. Good work on your drug disposal flyer. Let's have more public and environmental health in the coming year. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any other comments?
I'm Mike Zelenia from Cambria. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight. I'd also like to thank the Health Commission for placing our report on the website, and I agree with all of Elizabeth's comments. It really is an unfortunate statement that the Health Commission spent all this time on a report that they landed up having to file 2 additional reports in order to get something balanced on the website. It's just unfortunate that that's the way it had to be, but I'm glad that it's up there now so people get a more balanced view of the situation. I do want to review for the public the reasons why we had such a concern about the report to begin with. The people that were on the committee were the 2 leads were one was a vice president of research and development for Zeneca Ag, who claimed that he was now a farmer, which he is in Cambria, but didn't disclose that connection until someone from the public raised it. There was a researcher that works at Cal Poly who was took funding from Monsanto, and then there's the connections of the chair that led that committee, which clearly there are conflicts of interest there that were not disclosed. And the public, even when we found these out, we still worked with the committee to try to make the report balanced, and it didn't turn out that way. And I think in order for this health commission to gain the trust of the public, a large segment that voted yes on Measure Q to just ban the stuff outright, you know, it's 50,000 people that voted. It wasn't a tiny segment of the population. I think that needs to change, and I have a lot of other stuff here. But I just want to say that this health commission is in a unique position because you are not elected officials. And so you can do bold moves to protect the public interest, and maybe more so than the politically elected people can. And I honestly don't see that happening with a chairperson who has such tight connections to agriculture. You know, the elephant in the room is that agriculture uses pesticides and herbicides that we know cause cancer, that we know cause birth defects. And we need, and GMOs are an extension of that. They are the industrial agriculture model. And they're being unreleased or released into the public without proper testing. And it would be great if this health commission could do what virtually any other area in the country has been unable to do, which is to take a real look at this and to act in the public interest to protect this. In my 27 seconds, I'll say, since we published our report, GMO rice has been discovered in the food supply. You may not have heard of this because the media doesn't cover it very well. Never, it wasn't tested for human consumption. It's now in the food supply. The farmers in the southeast that plant rice have had to plant it anyways, even though it's not approved for human consumption, because they didn't have enough seed. And guess who they're selling it to? The United States, because we'll eat it. Nobody else will in the whole world. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Zelina. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak? I'm going to make one very quick statement and tell you that I have absolutely no financial interest in my brother-in-law's farm. It is a small family farm, his family, not mine. I don't get one dime from Richard N's Farms. I don't even know what crops he might have grown that you think are genetically modified. I actually have no knowledge of his business practices. So that's, you're barking up the wrong tree when you try to say that I have some sort of agricultural conflict of interest. I can't help who I'm related to, but that doesn't have anything to do with how I would conduct a committee. So that being said, we'll move on to the first item of business, and that is the ocean water monitoring. And we have Kurt Batson here to begin the presentation. Thank you for being here, Kurt.
Good evening. It's been a while since I've been before you. But what I'd like to do tonight is two things. Describe pretty much in general what our ocean water monitoring program is about. And then I've brought Rich Lichtenfels with me to give you a little more of a specific update about the Pismo Beach situation, because that seems to be the one that's driving a lot of the interest these days. But actually, our ocean water monitoring program is 20 sites along the coast, ranging from Oceano up to San Simeon. And we do three tests when we go out, and we do them once a week. And these tests are for total coliform, fecal coliform, and enterococcus. These are all organisms that live in the gut of a warm-blooded animal. But that's about all that our testing will tell us. They won't tell us the source. They won't tell it that's a human source or an animal source, only that it's a mammal and that it comes from the gut of a mammal. And so total coliform organisms can be in the soil and can be in a lot of different places. Fecal coliform is generally confined to the gut of an animal, and enterococcus as well. But we do these tests once a week, and we compare them to a state standard. When they exceed those state standards, we post a health advisory. That's generally what you hear about in the paper or something where some people refer to it as closing the beaches. Well, we're really not closing the beaches. We post a health advisory that advises people to stay out of the water. Sometimes we know the source. Occasionally it's happened over the years where we've had a discharge from a wastewater treatment facility, and it's made its way to the ocean. In those cases, we do actually close the beach. We do actually post different, they're completely different signs for that matter. But that happens fairly infrequently, and I can only think of maybe two or three times in the last couple of years where that has occurred. Once we post the health advisory signs, we take follow-up samples that same day. And it's about an 18, 24-hour time period before we get the results. And when we get the results, either we leave the signs up, or if they continue to exceed the standard, or we take the signs down if they meet the standard. So those are done on a daily basis until the samples clear up. That's pretty much what happens. The cost of the program that we do currently costs the county somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 a year total. That's staff costs. That's everything. We receive about $50,000 total in revenue from grants from the state. So the county contributes somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 of general fund into the program. One of the things that we've been working on actually for more than a year now, it's been a couple years, are permanent signs. One of the flaws that we recognized a long time ago is the signs that we post, they're made out of like almost like a light cardboard or a heavy paper. They don't stay there for many reasons. Sometimes it's the wind, sometimes it's wet weather or something, sometimes it's people. I suspect that we have these signs inside dormitories, rooms, and things like that, where people take the signs and post them as some memento of their stay in San Luis Obispo County or that. So those kinds of things happen, and it's not unusual. But it does create a problem for us in that we try to advise the public in a number of different ways. One is on our website. The media is contacted. And these signs, because some people do not get that information the other way, and the signs are at the beach. But it's not very foolproof in that they do not last oftentimes. So we embarked on a project a couple years ago to create some more permanent signs. The signs that in my mind I came up with were much too expensive. My plan A I couldn't do because I just couldn't afford the size, the materials, it was just too expensive. So we came up with a plan B, which is our current permanent signs. We can afford them. I'm told, going to be ready this week. It has been a couple of months since they've been to the sign maker. And they're a flip sign, essentially. They're closed. When everything is good, they stay closed. And when things are bad, we open them up and they say, you know, it's the health advisory signs. There'll be, at the present time, we can afford one sign at each sampling location. In subsequent years, we hope to maybe improve on that a little bit where we can post them. There might be a number of signs depending upon the location, access to that particular location. But right now, I can afford 20 signs. They are in English and Spanish on the same. There's not two different signs. It's just one sign. But they're in English and Spanish. And I hope to have them going up in the next week or two. Just as soon as we get them, they're going to go in. And we have the money. That's not an issue at this point to get them put up. The last thing I wanted to mention is Heal the Bay does a report card on beaches throughout the state. And in San Luis Obispo County, 19 of our 20 locations received either an A or an A-, which is very good. However, we do have a problem location, and that's our Pismo Beach site, particularly the location just south of the pier. And we've had that problem for a while. It's been in several years we've recognized it. It seems that it's gotten worse this last year in that the number of consecutive days of having a health advisory posted is probably the most it's ever been. Overall, in terms of exceedances of the standards on all the sites, it's actually down from prior years. But that particular site is up, and we don't have a good explanation. But what I will have Rich come up and give you sort of what's going on with Pismo Beach, what are we doing about it, what do we hope to accomplish, and I'll let him finish with that, and then we'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Kurt. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I guess this is a good example of the trickle-down theory. You get to talk about all the good stuff, and I get the bad one. Anyway, there is the infamous Pismo Beach 4 sampling site. In the business, we call it PB4. It's a sampling site that is 40 feet south of the Pismo Pier, and this is what you hear about on the news and read in the newspaper. This has been our cross to bear with regard to beach water quality. Just to give you a reference as to where these where Pismo Beach has its sampling sites, there are three sampling sites. One is PB3, which is 300 yards south of the pier. There is PB4, our stinker site, which is 40 feet south of the pier, as I mentioned. And then there is the Wadsworth Avenue site, which is 300 yards north of the pier. So we have those three sites at Pismo Beach that we test every week. Just to give you an idea of the numbers about PB4, to give you some perspective, 10 of the 15 sample failures we've had up to this time for this year, 10 of the failures out of 15 have been at PB4. Last year, PB4 had a total of 16 sample failures, and again, that was more than any other site by far in the county. Why do we have so many failures? Well, you've probably heard about the pigeon situation. If you watch the news or read the newspaper, the pigeons have become the prime suspect, if you will, on the pier, because they do roost under the pier. They are on top of the pier during times when visitors are there during the day, and it's quite common to see folks feeding the pigeons. It's, I guess, since time immemorial, folks have determined that it's a good thing to feed the pigeons. It's a new world that we live in, so what's happening now is the city has passed an ordinance that will prohibit the feeding of birds on the pier. This is aimed at the pigeons primarily. They're hoping that through that effort, working with docent people who will hopefully volunteer to work on the pier to educate and inform the public that there'll be less feeding of the pigeons. Otherwise, you will be given a misdemeanor ticket and hauled into court, perhaps, if you're feeding the pigeons on a recurring basis. The city has also gone to great lengths to make sure that garbage cans, common things, easy things like lids for garbage cans, are installed. They've put in a real good effort to make sure that their sewer lines are not leaking. If you know anything about sewer lines in cities, you need to know that they inherently leak. Your sewer line, wherever it is, it leaks if it's in a city. That's just, in fact, the engineers build in a certain percentage of leakage of sewer. It's just the way it is. So what cities have done is they've purchased equipment that allows them to go in and actually take a TV camera down into the sewer line, and they can take a look at the sewer line to see if there's a crack or if there's damage to a sewer line pipe. So in a good faith effort by the city, they have done that. They did find, and you probably heard on the news, that there was a pipe that was found under a local restaurant adjacent to the pier, just north of the pier, that had a sagging pipe, sewer pipe. And according to Dennis Delsite, the public works director for the city of Pismo Beach, it looks suspect, but there is no actual evidence that the pipe has leaked at this point. So the city, just to be safe, is going to go in. It's going to cost them, I think, $120,000 to take a look at this pipe and repair it, even though it may not be leaking. So, like I say, the city's put forth a good faith effort to try to take care of things. Why PB4? When you take a look at the three sampling sites on the beach, PB3, PB4, and PB5, we don't have the recurring failures on PB3 and PB5. We have recurring failures just on PB4. So we're looking for the common denominator, and right now the prime suspect again is the pigeons. Solutions. The city has formed an ocean water quality group to address the beach issues facing the city, which the health department is a member of. We've been meeting monthly since December of last year. The city last week passed the ordinance prohibiting the feeding of birds on the pier. It takes effect. The ordinance takes effect July 19th. The city is working to put in place docent staff that will inform and educate pier area visitors, not just on the pier, but in the vicinity of the pier as well. The city of Pismo Beach has applied for a Proposition 50, Clean Beach Initiative grant from the State Water Resources Control Board to do a source identification study. And what this is, the scientists use DNA fingerprinting to try to determine which animals would be most suspect as far as contributing to fecal material in the surf zone. So, we're quite excited that the city, it looks like, has procured those funds. And last Friday, there was a meeting with the state and with Dr. Chris Kitts, who will be the scientist working to do the source ID study. They're going forward with the work plan, and it looks like it's a go for that grant, which is up to $450,000. It's been gratifying for the health department to work with the city. They put forth a good faith effort, as I said before. We're happy with their performance in trying to find a solution. Again, we can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for an informative presentation. And questions, Commissioner Hicks?
This might sound kind of... I'm very surprised to hear about the pigeons, but what about the humans that are all down in that one particular area where you've pretty much mentioned where all the hotels are, animals? Does that have an effect on it more than just the pigeons as well?
Well, here's what this DNA study we hope to tell us. My experience with these DNA studies, when they've been done in other places, there's usually not a single contributor to the problem. There's usually multiple contributors. The creek may be a contributor. We know that there's a homeless population that lives up along the creek. We know there's horses up along that creek. So there is a possibility that when they do this study, what they'll find is some percentage of the contamination is being contributed to by the birds, some by humans, some by dogs, some by horses. What that's going to do for us is when we get that information, we will be able then to say, okay, where do we find potential human sources? And we can deal with that. Right now, we can only speculate. Obviously, the pigeons 30 feet away have got to be at least a good suspect. But there could be, like I said, there could be human contributions. We don't know that. There could be horses. I'm thinking there could be dogs because people take their dogs on the beach. There could be sea mammals, sea lions.
And I've seen a lot of dead ones down there recently.
A lot of dead?
Dead sea...
lions or sea...
No, the seals and...
Seals?
Yeah, and I've never seen that many dead animals on the beach like that in the past, and that was kind of disturbing. I guess one of my other questions is, are they going to ban all pigeon feeding, not just on the pier? Because I see people pull up every day at Grand Avenue, take out their bags, and feed those. I mean, the pigeons are huge, if you've ever been down in that area to see them.
Yeah, they're well fed.
Yes, they're very well fed.
You know, I don't know the nature of the ordinance. I didn't see the actual language, but generally when a city passes an ordinance, it's a citywide thing. It's, unless they wrote language into it that says specifically at the pier. I don't know that.
Commissioner Shimousis, then Commissioner Hetherington.
I wanted to know, are all the sites tested weekly?
Yes.
And there's other sites that are in very close proximity to piers, correct?
Yes.
There's several other piers in the area.
Yeah, Morro Bay.
Do pigeons not roost on other piers?
I don't think I could give you that answer. We haven't had a problem at these other locations nearly as often. Occasionally it happens, but it's very unusual. So the pigeons are at least the most likely. Okay. They're probably not the sole source.
Do the other piers in the area go through the same cleaning schedule as the Pismo Pier? I'm referring to the pressure washing and cleaning of the pier.
You know anything about that? Couldn't answer that one. Don't know.
Okay.
I could for just a moment to answer your question about piers and pigeons. It's a statewide problem. And so the city and the health department has been working with other folks up and down the coast of California to see what they've done with regard to pigeons. And again, this is a universal problem. So anytime there's studies done, everyone's watching. So it's kind of a landmark study. And we think there are going to be some extras that come out of this study that would be able to benefit the state of California and maybe the nation. So we're kind of excited to see how this is going to come out.
Thank you. One other quick question. Are you at all considering testing the creek water in conjunction with the ocean water?
I actually happen to have that, yes. And yes, we have. The problem with creeks, let me tell you a little bit about creeks and coliform bacteria. Yes, there will be coliform bacteria, particularly as the creeks tend to dry up and they stop flowing. And in this area, that happens. And so that's when they start getting worse. And then come next winter, when the first rains come, there's a big flush out into the ocean of all this stuff that has accumulated for 6 months. And that's when we oftentimes have our problems. We have taken some samples at the creek recently just to see what contributions. And as we suspected, yes, they're high in total and fecal coliform. At least the first sample was that was taken on the 22nd of May. The second one that was taken, there was the total coliform. They were below our standard, which surprised the heck out of me. And so did the one on the 5th of June was below. And the fecal coliform dropped by 2/3 at both at that same location in the creek in the fall, you know, on May 29th and June 5th. What does that mean? I can't tell you. I don't know. It again, we know that it comes from the gut of a warm-blooded animal, and that's about the most I can tell you. Our studies, I don't think, will include samples out of the creek in terms of the DNA study, but the ocean is where we're most concerned about.
The creek will be included, it sounds like.
Oh, okay.
In the study.
Very good.
My turn? Okay. My first question is going to go to the pigeons, because it's just recently that we've had this serial closure, and the pigeons' population hasn't varied. The people feeding the pigeons on the pier haven't varied. So
why the pigeons?
Why are you blaming the pigeons?
Okay.
And let me remind you, Dr. Kitt's study that he did in Los Osos was inconclusive about where the leakage into the bay was coming from. So I'm not holding a lot of weight that he's going to be able to solve this problem. Like you said, he's going to tell you what you already know. It's probably multiple sources. But back to the pigeons.
Let me answer a little bit about the pigeons. We've been doing this this program at this level for
since 2001.
Since 2001.
So I very well remember.
We didn't have a program prior to that except during the storms. But anyway, the pigeon, actually we have had recurring problems at that location in prior years. So we haven't had it where it lasted, like, I think it was 8 or 9 consecutive days that we had this year. That was a little different. But we have had it to where that location, I think last year was, again, the highest occurrence of exceedances of that standard. And last year was the same way. I don't know if we have data from the year before, but PB4 has been a challenge for us every year. So this isn't new, although this is more of what I would expect rather than what we were getting is we get a high count and then the next day it cleared up and then we'd come back the next week. That's more of a mystery to me than the consecutive days given the circumstances. But I don't have an answer for you as to why that's occurring. I just don't know.
Well, I guess it would be more obvious if it was the pigeons that it would be more consistently that way like it's been this year.
Yeah.
But yet again, your pigeon population is not varying by that big of a degree.
That's right. And throughout the year, we can go weeks and weeks and weeks and have it be just fine. All I can say is these are samples. They aren't. We take a sample at a location. We know what's in that little bottle. It may or may not be completely representative of what you find in that location. So we do our best, but it is just a sample.
Couldn't you do gradient testing? You know where PB4 is testing high. Can you go 20 feet to the south and 20 feet to the north to try and see if it's even going towards the pier? I mean, I know that the other site is 50 feet, but, you know, where you're testing, where you're positive, I would think that you would be testing further out by so many feet until you figured out.
Yeah, well, we have, you know, we've been asked to do weekly, our daily testing, and we've been asked to do several different things. And it comes down to how much effort and money can we keep putting into it. And we tend to try to balance that throughout, you know, the whole county rather than spend all of our effort at one location. But yes, you could do some different days. We're going to try a different day to see if that has any bearing on it. It might be that something that happens during the weekend is what the issue is and not the pigeons. There's a lot of possibilities. I'm only pointing at the pigeons because they're the most obvious. They may not be, I would be surprised if they weren't a contributor, but they may not be the main contributor. And that's why we're doing some of this other testing to see what we can find. The creek doesn't seem to be, other than a little bit in the winter, doesn't seem to be the major variable, but it could be. I just don't have the answers that everybody would like to have, actually.
Okay. I have a couple more questions.
I'll give you every answer I can.
Over the Memorial Day weekend, the beach should have been closed. It wasn't posted right away. Is that a violation of the health and safety code, that it wasn't posted when it was supposed to be?
I'm trying to think. I don't think it's a violation of the health and safety code. It is that we have a contract or an agreement with the state that we will post. We're not even required. Let me tell you this part of the story because I didn't mention this earlier. What the law says we're supposed to do is only spend the amount of money that the grants will provide us. So if I only did that, if I met the minimum requirements of the state, I would reduce our program by 2/3 because we only get $50,000 and we spend $150,000. So I would maybe sample 5 sites or something like that throughout the county. That is the minimum requirement of the state. I don't think that's such a great idea. So we do more, and we've convinced the Board of Supervisors it's an important issue. And so they agreed that we can spend the extra county dollars. So to say, is it a violation to not have posted it? I haven't even researched that. I don't think so, but I have not researched it. It should have been posted. I'm not going to make any excuses. We didn't get out there as quickly as we should have.
My last question for right now. Given the fact that the city is saying that there's a sagging sewer pipe and that you're at the table with the city, but there's more than just the county and the city at the table, is my understanding.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I'm surprised that somebody hasn't suggested a dye test from the sewer plant to see if it comes out at the beach area. You know, I know that that's been done in places like Irvine, Huntington Beach, you know, and other coastal areas that are having spikes in water quality challenges. Has that been discussed at all?
I haven't been attending those meetings.
It has not been discussed. No.
It has not.
I'd like to sow that seed before $500,000 goes to pigeon poop. Okay.
Well, I think that no matter what we do, we need to find out what's causing the contamination. Because until we do, we can't focus our efforts on solving that. If it turns out that it's a significant human contribution instead, then we can focus on the sources of human contribution. It's a whole lot easier rather than the sort of, well, we'll try this and see what happens to the sample and we'll try that. I think that it's money well spent to identify the DNA source. And we can then focus on those issues much better than we can where we're right now. We're just saying, you know, it could be any warm-blooded animal. And that's not a very easy way to resolve the issue. So I really think that the dye test has its benefits, and it can be used in some circumstances, and it has its circumstances where it doesn't provide very conclusive evidence. So, but it isn't something that should be ignored. It certainly is an option.
Any other questions from the commission? Commissioner Donnelly?
I don't have a button.
Hello?
Oh, it works. Okay, sorry.
One of the things, I'm just a little bit confused in terms of sequence, because you had mentioned there is an ordinance that's going to go into effect July 19th, correct? Where they won't be able to feed the pigeons anymore.
That's correct.
So is there any kind of history or data available that where those types of ordinance have taken effect? And, I mean, at what point in time after that would we, if it was a huge part of it, at what point in time after that would we expect to see the levels go down? And then the timing of when the investigation starts, you know, with in conjunction with the ordinance, I was just, you know, wondering, is that going to start before or after? If you can just...
Well, let me tell you a little bit about my professional opinion about the ordinance. I think what we're trying to accomplish is we're trying to do whatever we can to reduce the contaminants associated with this. And I think the ordinance is an attempt to do that. Do I think the pigeons are going to disappear on July 20th? No. They're going to be there. Are they going to, even July 20th of 2008, are they going to be gone? No. There's still going to be pigeons there. There's the intentional feeding of pigeons, and then there's the unintentional feeding of pigeons. And they're going to take advantage of whatever options. Hopefully it will reduce the population. Will it eliminate it? No. It's not going to eliminate it. Pigeons are all around. They're everywhere. So what all we're trying to do is we're trying to find what are the possibilities and where we can minimize or eliminate that possibility. And in this case, it happens to be the pigeons. It's the sewer lines. It could be a lot of other things. Some of them we can't control. The sea lions, those sea mammals that could contribute to it, there's not a thing I can do about those. So that all we're trying to do is our best to reduce the burden and hope that it reduces it far enough to get it below the standard. I don't, as far as the timing on the on when they expect to start doing the DNA testing, I don't know. Rich might know more about that.
The study would take at least a year to conduct. It's my understanding that if the city finds out through the efforts that they're putting forth now with the ordinance and so forth, lids for garbage cans, some real easy things first. If the failures stop, then there's probably not going to be a study. So the city feels strongly about that, and everyone's interested in making sure that we don't waste money on an effort like this. So,
thank you. That's kind of what I was wondering, if they were going to see what happened, you know, since this is the prime suspect.
Sure.
And how long would you expect to see results in that? And then would they be holding off on the study until we really know what's going on? Or
the answer is yes.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Commissioner Tilsher, are you, did you want to say something? Thank you. And then Commissioner Shimousis, and then Commissioner Hetherington.
Hi. Thank you for coming. A couple quick questions about the signs that you're rolling out this week, end of this week.
Well, they're supposedly going to be done. I was told in a phone call this morning, today or tomorrow.
Well, I think
they told us last week also. But,
I think that's great news. I know it's a problem. My son surfs there, and he tells me constantly he never saw a sign. I don't know if I believe him or not, but...
Well, I can tell you that the news media has said, where'd you put your sign? We tell them exactly where we put it because they want to go and take a picture of it. It's gone. So we've recognized it as a problem for a long time.
Well, and that was my question is, you said you're going to have one sign per site. Where will that go, and are there assurances in place that they won't end up in dorm rooms as well?
Well, I mean, if they do, they're going to have to go to a whole lot of effort. They're going to be mounted, they're metal, they're going to be mounted to a fixed post or a wall or a pier piling or whatever is the best location. We're working with the city and Pismo Beach, but we're going to be working with every location, the state parks, city of Morro Bay, all the people who have some responsibility for the beach in various locations, and the Surfrider Foundation to at least identify the best location if we only have one location per site. My view of this thing is maybe in subsequent years I can get enough money to where, because I'm almost sure that there's multiple entries to many of the locations, and it would be good to have more than one sign. That's what I hope to be able to do, is to eventually put them where they would affect the most people who are going in. But right now, I can only afford the one location, one sign per location. It's just a fiscal issue.
Great. You answered my next question, which is the multiple points of entry, and I understand.
I'm certain that there are other ones. That's why, the reason why we're hoping for the surf riders. They tend to spend more time down there. They probably know where the most common entry is at this point.
Thanks.
Yeah, that answered my question also, except for one aspect of it. Are the signs where they flip down, are they lockable?
Absolutely. Okay. Lock closed and lock open. And we have the key.
Thought of one more, Kurt. Good. Could you tell, I know that we have people watching this program at home, what the symptoms and signs are if somebody's in the water and the coliform levels are postable? What are they going to experience possibly?
Well, that's a lot, because here's the reason why coliform organisms are used is not because of their pathogenic capacity. They in and of themselves may or may not actually be pathogenic, but they're called an indicator organism. What you would expect is, if you're finding, and these studies have been done by the state, if you're finding these higher levels of these enteric organisms, then you might find a higher probability of disease. But these organisms in and of themselves are not being tested because of their pathogenic capacity. Now, to answer your question, what kind of symptoms might you experience? The more common symptoms are things like ear infection, eye, maybe throat, sore throat, maybe possibly some gastroenteritis, nausea, that kind of thing, depending upon the organism you actually ingest. Those would be the ones I would be most looking for. Maybe a dermatitis, skin rash. But it doesn't mean that they necessarily came from the organisms that we are testing. They may have a common source, being the gut of a warm-blooded animal. Okay.
Does that do it for the questions from the commission? Okay. Then it's the opportunity, the public now has an opportunity to make a comment or ask questions. If you would like to do so, please come forward, state your name. Yes, 3-minute comments or question.
But I can ask a question without being timed on the question, right? It's a simple question that's 5 seconds. Mr. Baskin can take a
ask your question, and we'll just have him answer it. Don't worry too much about that.
It's just about the mammals.
Could you go to a microphone so that everybody can hear what you're saying?
Yes.
And yes.
I'm Jeff Pinak. And I'm here as a public citizen of Oceano, and also as a member of Surf Rider Foundation in Slo County. Mr. Batson, on the TC and FC measurements that we are taking when we test at the pier at places, you said that was a measurement only of mammals.
That's my understanding of the source of the organisms that we can identify in these tests.
In the tests that are being taken by the county.
Right.
Okay. You can start my 3 minutes.
Okay.
And it's at 2:20 now, so I get an extra 30. First of all, regarding the mammals, and what if it's only measuring mammals, then pigeons are not mammals. So what about pigeons? Why are we focusing on pigeons? Surfrider's been studying this problem for a really long time. We've been at it for over a year. We're currently meeting individually with the Board of Supervisors individually. We are concerned about lots of different things. I want to correct Mr. Batson and Rich. Mr. Lichtenfels, that the dye test has been discussed with both of you. I discussed a dye test with you personally in our meeting, and we discussed a dye test at the Pismo Beach Blue Water Task Force meeting also to test the ocean outfalls. I'm going to read something from Surfer Magazine. Let's keep it clean. Each year, 1.8 million to 3.5 million illnesses are caused by swimming in water contaminated by sewage. Sydney, Australia, 80 to 90% of the time, their beaches were closed because their sewage outfalls were not far enough out. The problem was eliminated in 92 after an extensive environmentalist campaign forced the government to treat sewage to secondary levels and build long-range ocean outfalls 5 miles offshore. I want to say that our outfall at Oceano is it's approximately between a third and a half a mile offshore. The World Health Organization recommends that a sewage outfall be at least 1 mile offshore and be in at least 60 feet of water. Ours is in 30 to 40 feet of water. There's a current that flows from south to north from the shoreline out to 2 miles out. It's called the Davidson Current. And what it does is constantly pull everything towards Pismo Pier. We tested in the area of Pier Avenue Oceano and found it to be relatively clean of organisms and not a problem, whereas Pismo would test high on the same days. I'm going to pass around a reading that we did on Friday, the day after, at a new location, as a matter of fact, that the gentlemen over here have not revealed to you that they are now testing on a 50 feet north of the pier, just right outside of the sagging, quotes, maybe not leaking, sewer pipe. That's the test from the day after. Their test tested at 384. Our test the next day tested at 900, which the beach would have had to have been advised for that weekend. Here's a result from testing Pismo Creek. And you can see that Pismo Creek tests, that's just a Pismo Creek test. We tested a few times, that's one test. 7,000 fecal coliform, 30,000 total coliform, Pismo Creek. So I'm probably way over my time, and turn it over to the next.
Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment?
Hello. I'd like to thank the commission for this opportunity to speak. My name is Jennifer Blonder. I am a teacher, I am a surfer, and I'm a member of Surfrider and a concerned citizen of Pismo Beach. As a teacher and a surfer, my two main concerns on this issue are the health of the ocean, my health as a surfer, and the health of children who play in the water. I brought some items here that I've been having to use because I got an ear infection from surfing just north of the pier. I have some ear drops, antibiotics, earplugs. Have to use them regularly in order to heal my ear infection. I also, on the weekend of Memorial Day, actually it was May 26th, I have the advisory here. They posted an advisory on the website, but there was no signage posted at the beach that weekend. And I saw a lot of children playing in the water, and that really bothered me. And so I took it upon myself to let some people know, hey, you might not want to let your kids in the water because you can get an ear infection. They could get gastrointestinal illness. There's lots of things that can happen to kids, and they're very susceptible. It really worries me and saddens me when the city's not posting and there's those issues, the contamination in the water. Surfrider also received a letter from a lady who was concerned about her child and was going to take him to the hospital because he was sick from that weekend. So there's a lot of concern for the health of people. And you can't put a price on health. Cannot put a price on health. That should be number one issue, right? So I've been observant about how other cities and communities take care of these issues when there's contamination or danger in the water. I look at Avila Beach when there's a shark sighting, and I see that they line their beach with signs. You can't miss it. There's shark signs all over the place. You can't miss it. Recently, when San Diego had to close their beach because of diesel contamination, the The lifeguards were involved. The city was involved. The public health was involved. There were signs all over the place. They quoted that they were doing everything they could to keep people out of the water. So when we put these signs up, these permanent signs that Mr. Batson has been talking about, I think it's a great idea, but I want to make sure, I want to know that they're going to be in every possible high traffic location, the hotels, the pier entrances, where all the surfers go down. There should be no question for anybody who's coming to visit with children, elderly people, surfers, anybody who's going to enjoy that water. There should be no question whatsoever for them to have a choice whether or not they go into that water. They need to have a choice. They deserve a choice, because the illnesses that can be imposed upon somebody from coming into contact with this kind of contaminant, it's dangerous. And if it costs more to put up more signs, well, fine. I mean, you can't put a price on health. That should be our number one issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anybody else?
Jennifer Joswick from Shell Beach. I am also a teacher, and I am vice chair of Surf Rider. A couple of things I'd like to talk about. When Mr. Batson was talking about that long stretch of time where the beach was posted in Pismo, approximately May 3rd, there was a reading, and I'm on the Blue Water Task Force with the City of Pismo and the County Health and the Regional Board and Salmon Enhancement. We've been doing this since September of 06. So I am privy to the reports. Liberty Amundson does email them to me. A fecal coliform reading of 670 and total coliform of 823. On 5-4, it was fecal 820, total coliform 1,014. On the 5th, was 441 fecal and 512 total coliform. And on the 8th, 712 fecal and total 813. It's pretty shocking numbers, pretty shocking to me. And we have information that the county has shared with us that shows, especially in the summer months, August from 2004, we have extremely high increases, 2005 even higher, 2006 the highest. So this is a dry period when we are having this intense problem. We expect this in a rainy period to have high warnings because of the stormwater runoff. So it's very alarming to us, because this is when the majority of beachgoers are in the water. So let's talk about the testing. Testing is done once a week at Pismo. It's done on a Tuesday. This does not give any warning to the tourists that are in our area. As Jeff Pinack mentioned, that reading of 900 was on a Saturday. And we do not have the opportunity to post signs because we are not an authority, but this Creek Lab does the same testing that the other agencies use as well. So what we need is more testing days. We need testing before the big weekends, before the tourists are in town, so on a Thursday, on a Saturday, so that the county does have time to get there and post several signs, flip the sign, whatever we're going to have in the next month. Hopefully it's the permanent sign that they can flip. But we need several days of testing during the week, because we have a serious problem here. And I surf regularly 4 to 5 times a week. I've been sick frequently over the last few years. And we're collecting quite a bit of data at this point from other people getting ill as well. So I would encourage any participation or facilitation that you can do in this issue to assist us in advocating for more testing and more funds going towards this agency. Thank you.
I just have a quick question. You mentioned that more testing, and of course that equals more money spent by the county. And sometimes when funds aren't there, volunteers can take up the slack. And it sounds like your organization's very involved in doing these kinds of things. Would that be something where you could have a partnership of, I don't know whether there's a legal problem with that, I really don't know, but is that something where a partnership could occur so that the county would not have to spend funds it might not have?
And I'll speak to that. I did speak at the Pismo City Council meeting and suggested that we all work on a partnership together. If this problem is mainly lying in Pismo, which at the time it is, We believe that Pismo, the city of Pismo, should also contribute to this extra funding. Another possible solution that Supervisor Gibson told us was to maybe temporarily reallocate the resources. So instead of testing as often at San Carpaforo Creek, which always tests positive, which is always fine, spend more money and more time testing the high-use beaches. So a temporary reallocation. But certainly, Surf Rider members would be more than happy to get more involved and do more testing.
Okay, thank you. Did you want to ask her a question?
Yeah, I have several questions. Number one, nobody gave us a baseline as to what is acceptable and what is outside the law of acceptability. Everybody says, oh, it's this high, that high, and so on. Where's the threshold? That's my first question, is where's the threshold? And secondly, by this that you have handed out, you are collecting yourself versus the county collecting. The question that I have for that is, are you apples and apples? Or are you apples and oranging? Is your method exactly the same as the county's method? And if it isn't, then what's the discrepancy by their baseline versus your baseline?
Do you want to answer the levels?
Go ahead.
The EPA has a recommended threshold, and it differs from the state thresholds. The EPA recommends an advisory don't enter the water recreationally at 200 fecal coliform.
Per ml, is that what you're talking about? 200 per ml?
Mr. Batson?
Yeah.
I don't know the per ml. It's the
number.
Well,
there's a lot of difference if it's
but it's a standard number.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Because I have no idea, and I hear all these different answers, and the question is, are we the same, or are we apples
and
oranging?
The state standard is
400. The state standard is 410,000. So it's 410,000 and 201,000 U.S.
I enforce state regulations. I don't enforce EPA guidelines or recommendations.
Okay.
And the regulations are it's 10,000 for total coliform. It's 400 for
per how per what volume?
Per ml.
Per ml. Okay.
And it's 10,000 total, 400 fecal, and 104 for Enterococcus. So the numbers that were being read off a little earlier, they didn't sound like they exceeded the total coliform at all. They were exceeding the fecal coliform, which in any one of these can be too high and trigger the same response. So they don't have to have all three or two out of three or any one of the three exceed and it triggers the same reaction.
Per 100 ml.
Oh, per 100. Well, that's a different. That's why I asked this question, because I didn't know what you were doing, whether they're the same. I mean, you can't compare if you don't have the same baseline. That's the bottom line, whether you eventually move it to matching that or you move it or they move to matching yours. But to say that you've got this much and you're using a different base and you've got this much and you're using a different base, no, it's worthless.
The numbers are the same.
It's the same baseline.
It's the same baseline. It's the same numbers from Creek Lab or what county is reporting. Yeah.
It's both the same test.
Okay.
It's just done, Creek Labs does the test, which we contract with, because we can't use the county's lab. And the county uses their own lab.
We have our own public health lab is the one that does this work. And we, again, what I'm talking about, those 10,400 and 104 are the places, those are the standards that we use when we compare, and that's what determines whether or not we post a sign or we post a health advisory. And it doesn't matter what the EPA recommendations are. They do have lower recommendations often than what the state standards are, but I can't react to the EPA recommendations. I have to, my legal authority goes with what the state requires.
State standard. So the question that I have for you is when you're complaining about the amount, you're looking at your baseline as saying that this is the amount that you should close, but the state has a different standard. And based upon that, we're looking at apples and oranges. They're saying
no,
that
we're not.
Could I just interject here for a moment? Let's re-clarify this, just so that it's clearer to us. You all are working with these numbers and you're used to them. Mr. Batson gave us the standards for either the total, the fecal, and the enterococcal, right? So the numbers then that you gave us, what were those? Were they total, fecal, or enterococcal? Could you, that maybe
yes,
that would make
the,
it more.
The numbers I read to you from, let's say, May 3rd, says fecal coliform, 670.
Coliform.
Fecal coliform, right. 670, MPN-100 milliliters.
And if, Ms. Horn, if, as you're looking at the piece of paper right there.
Right, yeah, I have the.
You'll see that it says, one says total coliform and one says fecal coliform. There's two lines there. And there's two different numbers. There's two numbers. Sometimes they're the same number. Sometimes they're two different numbers.
Where does it say total? Oh, okay. Gotcha. You're right. I missed that completely. Okay.
So the measurement, we're measuring the same thing. It's not an apples to oranges measurement because our lab, when I say our lab, Creek Labs is a county lab that does so many different tests for so many different people and agencies and groups and cities and thing municipalities in the county that they are very well known in the industry and in the county. And of course the county lab does the same testing, and of course it's great that they have their own in-house testing, that they don't have to spend more money to get the testing done by an outside entity.
Well, okay.
And if I could add something here that may be valuable.
Okay.
The intention that we have, all of us, is to get clean, healthy water in our ocean.
Right.
And that's I don't want to misconstrue this, and we're not trying to say the job's not being done right and we wish that something that we could get this done or that done. The really overarching goal is better water quality, a healthy ocean for, as Jen said, a healthy ocean for the people who recreate in it, not just surfers, not just swimmers. And it's also a goal of ours to have a healthy ocean environment for all the ocean life that needs to sustain us as humans for the rest of our time living on this earth. And really, I charge all of us, the Health Commission, the County Environmental Health Department, the County Board of Supervisors, I charge all of us and individual citizens to become concerned about this ocean environment in that it really needs our help, and it needs our help now. And I'm going to applaud the efforts of the Cayugas and Morro Bay JPAs, who recently advocated tertiary treatment in their sewage system up in Morro Bay and Cayugas, because tertiary treatment allows the final effluent to not flow into the sea, but to be reused and put into the groundwater here on land, and recharge our aquifers and recharge our groundwater and essentially water plants and parks and things like that. So I applaud that, and I look for the rest of our county, i.e. the Oceano outfall, which is Pismo and Oceano plants joint line, I look to be able to see that line eliminated and tertiary to happen at both Pismo, which has the capability to upgrade to tertiary. When they did their sewer upgrade, they made it so that it would be able to handle a tertiary upgrade quickly and easily. And, of course, Oceano is our only county plant, and it's in the county, and it handles the five cities. I live in Oceano. And that county plant is currently not tertiary, and tertiary really is the overarching goal of what we need. We need to stop putting things out into the ocean and using the ocean as a dump site.
Commissioner Guerena?
A quick question for you. It sounds like the Blue Water Task Force does a lot of measuring out there. Do you measure the creek, and do you also measure, I think of the wall there with these pipes coming out with fluid coming out of that. Do you ever measure what comes out of there? And if you ever measure the creek, do you ever follow the creek up and take measurements as far up as you can go and see what you find? Because it sounds like, you know, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about protecting the public now, but we also need to stop it. We need to find out where it's coming from.
We've definitely done testing a little bit up the creek. I thought, Jeff, you had done some testing in the past, but we're advocating for PISMO's grant to do testing not only in the water around the pier, but up the creek. We are definitely asking for that to be done. Jeff, could you enlighten him on any of the testing you've done?
Yeah, just a little bit. The overarching goal, again, is to look at this as not a one specific culprit type thing, because there really isn't an easy solution and a way to point the finger and say, well, it's the pigeons. Yeah, the pigeons may have some input. The creek probably has some input. Sagging and breaking sewer lines that are ancient, could they have some input? Yes. Could the ocean outfall have some input? More likely than not, yes. So when we look at all these things, we will be making a presentation shortly, I hope within the next few months, at a Board of Supervisors meeting, where we're going to really spell out all the different things that we hope to get the county to focus on, to test, to do certain tests, so we can pinpoint the source and sources of where these problems are coming from and why we have a 900 fecal coliform count 50 feet south of the pier the day after a 340 fecal coliform, same spot, and why it goes up and down and like this. Because if it was just the pigeons, and if in fact the measurements we're doing measure pigeon fecal, which they may not according to the mammal measurement, well then it shouldn't spike up and down, as Pam said. It shouldn't spike up and down. It should be a pretty constant, because there's a certain amount of pigeons there, and they poop a certain amount of times per day, and it drops down straight into the water at the pier, and it should gradiently go lower and lower as we go away from the pier. So there's all these different things, and it's like being detectives somehow.
But to answer his specific question, when we test in knee-deep water, and it is in those spots close to the pier. Jeff tested 50 feet north of the pier, which is not one of their regular testing sites, and you've also regularly tested Wadsworth and south of the pier, but always up to about knee-deep water, which I believe is higher than what the county tests in. I believe
yours
it's,
is knee-deep too, right?
No, is it knee-deep?
Yours is knee-deep as well.
Knee-deep as well.
Okay. Well, okay. Oh, wait a minute. One more. Commissioner Donnelly.
This whole dialogue has caused me to have a ton of questions, but I'm going to try to limit them to the ones that I think are most important. Because you had talked about the urgency of dealing with this issue now, and it seems to me that there may be, I mean, a way to work together to at least help each other. So one of the questions that I have is, and it had already been brought up about you guys working more together on this, do you ever offer your results that you get on these other days that you test to the Environmental Health Services Department? And if you do, and then I have a question for Mr. Botson. Do you find these results from a credible source, and do you acknowledge them, and would you accept them as results and be willing to make postings based on those results?
Do you want to answer that one?
I can do that.
We share data with Liberty, and we've been doing that on a regular basis on our sporadic testing. I need to just clarify that we're not in a regular testing mode right now, and we have not been since
last year. Last year we did test for 1 year period, and we did give them our information, and we shared that with the PISMO task force.
Right. but we're very sporadic testing now.
Our samples, in order for me to take a legal action, which is, you know, taking a privilege away from people, or at least recommending that, at least the health advisory, I need to have certain things happen, and our testing methodology has to be followed very rigorously, and we have to be able to document that we did that. So while we actually have used in years past Surfrider to volunteer with us, and they took samples at locations that we weren't able to take samples. So they wanted a few others, and it helps us provide us information, but I can't take a legal action again with using it. But it's not that we ignore it. In fact, it's good information. And I don't have any question. We even trained the Surfrider folks at the time. We showed them our methodology for doing it. They brought us the samples, and our lab tested it. But in order for me to take a legal action, I have to have a little tighter controls than that. But they have been very helpful in a number of occasions where they've helped us in the past. It tends to get sporadic on occasion. I think it's based on the number of volunteers they can get to help and that sort of thing. But they have been very helpful. And I'm hopefully in all of this process, they'll continue to be that way. So.
Would we be able to... if we could collect the samples around Pismo.
If you want to speak, you have to do it in front of a microphone so everybody can hear.
Mr. Batson, if we could collect the samples around Pismo, especially during this time of, I won't call it a crisis because I don't want to use that word, but in this time of the broken sewer line, we had some concerns. We had a board meeting the other day and talked about the broken sewer line and that it's going to be repaired in the next, we hope, 7 to 10 days in Pismo. They're going to reline that sewer, that sagging sewer pipe, or we don't know the exact, we hope to find out on Thursday when we go to the Pismo Blue Water Force meeting, our water quality meeting, which Jen and I have been attending along with Dave Jewell and Richard and the other folks, the sound enhancement folks and the Pismo people. But we were hoping if your lab can actually process sampling of ours, if we can get volunteers to take those samples, we would very much love to have your lab analyze the samples from right around that Pismo Pier area, specifically the PB3, PB4, PB4A, the new one that you guys have 50 feet north of the pier, and then PB5, the 300 yards. So if we could sample those on a daily basis over the next two weeks or so, we would love to have you guys test them.
I'm not certain I can volunteer the public health lab to do anything, but I think that over a short-term period, perhaps Mr. Hamm could actually have a little more authority on that. But anyway, as long as it's on a short term, like a couple of weeks, I think that that's something that I can probably convince the public health lab to do. That's not my choice. I do not manage their resources, and so they could disagree with me, but I would certainly make that pitch for a short period of time that they would do increased samples, and I think they would probably be willing to do that. And we would just have to talk with you more about timing, because when they receive samples and their timing for processing is fairly specific. So we don't want to bringing in at a time when they're not able to do it. So we can certainly work out those details. And I wouldn't have a problem with talking with them about that.
Okay. This has been very interesting and very informative, and we appreciate your comments and participating in a rather unusual manner, but it works, so it's fine. But we do need to move on to the next agenda item. So thank you all who were here. And excuse me. We do? What possible action might we make? Is there someone that would like to make some sort of motion about this presentation?
Well, I would like to have the Health Commission send a letter to the Board of Supervisors supporting expanded testing in this area until the problem's solved, and to support a collaboration, further collaboration, between all the partners at the table and hopefully have PISMO participate in funding some of the testing that Kurt doesn't. I wouldn't think he would have to be responsible 100% to do that.
Just to the Board of Supervisors, or would there be anybody else you'd like this letter to go to?
Regional Water Quality Control Board, the City of PISMO. I think everybody at the table should know that we've weighed in on this, because, you know, it's a public health problem.
Okay. So would you like to formalize your motion, and then we'll look for a second?
Okay. I move that we send a letter to all the participating organizations and agencies surrounding the PISMO Beach water quality problem to expand the testing, to ask for contributions from PISMO to help fund the testing. What else did I say? And that we support the wide collaboration that's going on towards that goal of healthy water.
Okay, there is a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Motion. There's a motion which has been seconded. Discussion. Is there any discussion from commissioners? Commissioner Donnelly?
I guess my discussion is one of the things, a big question that's still in my mind that I didn't get to ask Mr. Batson was, why is the Pigeons a primary suspect? Because before I would advocate for this, if there was some significant reason why they think that the Pigeons are causing it, I mean, I really want to know that, because I don't want to spend money that isn't necessary if that's the case. It doesn't sound like it is the case. It sounds like this would be an appropriate motion, but I just wanted to know if he could respond to that really quick before I can make my decision.
Would you care? Someone care to respond?
Madam Chair, I think the City of Pismo Beach is taking the corrective action in a stepwise fashion that makes sense. The first thing they're doing is talking about prohibiting feeding of birds on the pier, a good first step. Limiting access to garbage cans, making sure there are lids. TVing the sewer lines, trying to make sure that there aren't any obvious leaks in the sewer infrastructure. So I think they're doing the first things first that they should do, because they do have roosting pigeons under the pier. Our folks, when they take samples in the surf, knee-deep samples, they have oftentimes seen the pigeon fecal material in the water. It's that thick on some days. So we're not saying that's what it is exactly, but I think it's a prime suspect. When you talk about the sewer outfalls, a correction to the sewer outfall is, from what the gentleman mentioned, it's actually 5 miles south of Pismo, where it joins the Oceano sewer treatment plant outfall. It goes out 3/4 of a mile and is 60 feet deep. And so it would be they're testing every day to meet Regional Water Quality Control Board requirements. It would, from a logic standpoint, it would be amazing to me to see effluent coming from 3/4 of a mile out, 60 feet deep, back to the pier and not hitting any other of our testing spots. From a logic standpoint, doesn't make any sense. If I could, Madam Chair, mention one more thing, because this is a public health forum, and for the community-wide effort that we go through to make sure folks are apprised of our advisories, please be, I would like the public to be aware that we have a hotline. That number is 788-3411. I'll repeat it, 788-3411. Folks can call that number. They will get the latest advisory or beach closure information. That information is also on our website. And if folks don't remember the number, it's also listed in the Tribune on the back page with the weather. So really, when it comes to surfing, I've had a surfer in my family. There's really no excuse not to know what sites have an advisory or what sites are closed. You simply pick up the phone, 788-3411. You will know instantly of which sites are open and closed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there any further discussion on the motion? There being no further discussion, then we will take a vote. I think we can do this by a voice vote. So all those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Abstentions? It appears that the motion has passed unanimously. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Donnelly. Okay. The vote has passed with one abstention. And said letter will go out, and hopefully Jean took really good notes, so she'll remember exactly what it is I'm supposed to say. Oh, and you have it on tape. Good. Okay. Thank you, everybody that participated in this. We appreciate your time, and I also thank the people who are next on the agenda for being patient and waiting. And now we would like to welcome them on our subject of the medically fragile homeless. We have Jody Smith, EOC Director of Homeless Services, and Mary Miller, Patient Advocate. And we've been waiting to hear this presentation. We're very glad that you're here.
Good evening. I'm Mary Miller. I'm the Patient Advocate for the County of San Luis Obispo. And last month when I was here, I gave you just a quick update in regards to my program and what's going on in the county in regards to health care access. And I mentioned about the gap in services with the homeless, medically fragile homeless, and Jody is here to give us a quick update in regards to that.
Good evening. I've been very concerned as the director over the last year of the amount of folks coming through our services who are very medically fragile. We have an aging population, as you all know, I think I'm part of it. And we have a lot of people coming in with severe health issues. We've had a lot of cancer patients. We have folks with serious lung and heart conditions. We have folks with kidney failure needing dialysis. We've had very ill children. I have seen women who needed bed rest. I've seen sick children and premature babies in the last year and a half. I am extremely concerned as we have an emergency night shelter in San Luis Obispo, and it is not appropriate for someone to come into an emergency night shelter who has been just discharged from the hospital or is chronically ill. We have a shelter that opens at 6 o'clock at night and people need to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning. And there's nowhere for someone to go during the day to get bed rest. If you need to be in bed, being at the shelter is only going to work for you at night. If you're quite ill, the shelter is not an appropriate place for you to be because we cannot provide a sterile environment for someone that's on chemotherapy that's going to have a compromised immune system. I can't have someone coming into the shelter that's been on infusion therapy and has a heparin lock or has a portacath because they're receiving medications. I can't have very ill premature babies that have just been discharged from the hospital coming into the shelter. It would not be an appropriate setting for them, although we have had newborns, but a child that has a compromised immune system, it would not be an appropriate setting for them. I've dealt with many doctors prior to becoming director. When I was a case manager, I had folks that needed chemotherapy, but the doctors wouldn't start the chemotherapy until we were able to get them housed. Getting someone housed is not something that you do overnight. You can't even do it over a month's period of time. It takes a great deal of time and effort in our community when we have such a low inventory of rental units. We don't have the access to the Housing Authority special needs Section 8s that we used to. That's gone as a resource. So now what we're seeing is people who are coming to us that we can't have at the shelter. And it's really heart-wrenching. There is another nonprofit in our county, Transitional Food and Shelter, and they do motelling. But they have a finite amount of funding for their program. And so now we're having to triage who is going to use this finite funding. we're trying to guard everyone's resources. I'm guarding my own resources through homeless services because so many of the grants are shrinking before our eyes. Because I am so concerned, I did go over to Bakersfield, and I saw a program called Las Posada, and I believe that Mary gave all of you information last month. It's very interesting how other communities are addressing this problem with their medically fragile homeless. I was very impressed by the facility. I was impressed that someone could actually do something preventative to stay out of the emergency room, stay out of the intensive care unit. Someone could get discharged from the hospital and stay at a respite program for up to 2 weeks or longer if they needed to get their medical condition stabilized. What we have to do with many folks at the shelter is turn them right around and send them back to the emergency room because we don't have any other way that we can deal with their condition, and that's extremely costly. I frequently get phone calls from the discharge planners at the hospital, and they're wonderful to work with, and they're wanting the best for the patients in the hospital, but oftentimes I have to tell them, no, your patient cannot come to the shelter, they're too ill. What will we do with them during the day? Is this the most effective and efficient use of county money to have someone use their Medi-Cal card to go into the hospital only to be discharged, and I know they're going to become ill again, turn around and go back again? And we do have this discussion with the discharge planners, begging them to keep them for a few more days, and oftentimes they're able to do that. But this is a program that I would like to see in our county, a respite care program for medically fragile men, women, and children who are homeless. The other problem that we have is we don't have any hospice beds. Oftentimes, we have motelled people in their last days just so they won't die in a field like we had last summer across the street from the shelter. We had folks that passed away in the field outside. They were substance abuse people that could not come into the shelter because we are zero tolerance. And it was awful. It was an awful thing to put someone through, to put my staff through, to put the community through. If we had hospice beds, we would have a place for someone to die with dignity. Dying in a motel room alone is not dying with dignity. Dying in the back of your truck in a camper is not dying with dignity. Coming into the shelter and dying in the shelter has a little more dignity to it. About a year ago, Easter Sunday, I had an elderly gentleman with a serious heart condition. He wasn't sick enough to be in the hospital long term. We couldn't get him in a convalescent care hospital. So he passed away in the shelter early on Easter morning a year ago. We felt like that was the best we could do for him. But you know, I know that's not the best that we can do for people in our community. I believe that we all have a responsibility to help provide medical intervention, be it a respite care for a week or two, or a hospice bed. But I know we can do better, and I'm asking you to please advocate with the Homeless Services Coordinating Council and myself to do better in our community for folks that are less fortunate than we are and that are so vulnerable. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Could you give us a little more detail about the program in Bakersfield? Could you tell us how they managed to do that?
It's called Las Posadas. It's operated by Clinica Sierra Vista. They receive HUD funding, and they receive funding through Health and Human Services. And they do list some of the funding in their brochure. I took a copy of their budget over to the EOC office, so we do have a copy of their budget and their funding streams. This is one of 8 model programs in the United States, and I would urge you, if you're interested, I'll go with you, and we can go to Bakersfield and look at it. It's a house that is sitting on the site of a recovery home. It's this gorgeous recovery home. It's in the historic district of Bakersfield, and it is its own nonprofit. They opened up this other site, which is a small house on their property, and they have 6 beds for men and 4 for women. The meals are provided through the kitchen that provides the meals for the recovery home. And so the meals are provided. The medications are locked up next door in the recovery home because you've got, you know, different people's medications. You have to keep them under lock and key. And you need to have best practices. They do have an LVN who is in charge of the patients there. The patients need to be able to take care of themselves. I'd like to see a program here where even if you have someone who is quite ill, who maybe needs help in and out of a wheelchair, we're able to accommodate them. We have had people that are quadriplegics and paraplegics that have been too ill to be at the shelter, and what are you going to do? You've got somebody in a wheelchair that needs help. You need to have a medical staff person for them. We can't get them in the convalescent hospital because they have Medi-Cal and there's no room for them. And it's really hard. You have to get somebody to go stay at the motel with them to help take care of them. You have to hope that turns out okay because we're not there to supervise. It's a really tricky situation, and we're dealing with people's lives. I've had moms that were homeless. They lost their homes because of domestic violence, because of a lot of reasons. They need bed rest. We have to figure out how do we get bed rest for someone who's 8 months pregnant. We're trying to not have a premature baby. That's a very costly venture. It's so much cheaper to motel somebody for a month than to have them in the hospital with a premature baby in the neonatal unit. I mean, we're looking at prevention here and saving money. If you've got someone that is on chemotherapy, obviously it's smarter to have them in an environment where they're not going to be exposed to a lot of other illnesses, to keep them alive and to get the best results from that chemotherapy. I mean, there's just a lot of issues here, and we're not dealing with these issues in our community, and we absolutely need to. As much as transitional food and shelter is coming to our aid, they can just put so many people up a month because they're out fundraising their, you know, precious dollars, and we're supporting them. So we are so cautious in using that resource. So I just really, really hope that you're able to help in some way to advocate for our community and for our very medically fragile who are so vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from commissioners? Commissioner Hetherington?
Thank you for putting that at our feet.
Thank you.
You mentioned that the La Posadas has 10 beds, 6 men, 4 women. What is your vision for, say, a like type of facility in San Luis Obispo County? I think their population's larger than ours.
I would like to see at least 10 to 12 beds. And I'd like to see a way that we could all wrap our funding into supporting this. If we could get the community health center to help and Tenant and Catholic Healthcare West, if we could pull together those resources, we could put together a respite program. I'd like to, when a child is sick and they can't be at the shelter, let that family come and be in a safe place with that sick child instead of trying to figure out what motel room can we go and stick this family in, because we can't always get, especially in a holiday weekend, you can't get a motel room on Memorial Day or 4th of July. And, you know, we've had sick children. We've had kids with chickenpox and pneumonia and flu and lice, all kinds of things that children get. And it's really, really tough. We've had sick babies at the shelter that are spiking temperatures in the middle of the night, and it's kind of hard to get a hold of somebody in the middle of the night to get an authorization to try to get a motel room at midnight with a baby with 102 temperature. You want to get that crying sick baby out of the shelter and into a quieter place for the parent.
Are you working on a collaboration as we speak? I mean, do you have all the hospitals at the table? Do you have CHC at the table? Have you started that process?
I started this last summer with Lee Gulliver, who's the homeless services coordinator for the county. Unfortunately, she is retiring on Friday, but we will keep the ball rolling. Rod Youngquist is here tonight. He's the discharge planner from Sierra Vista. Been working with Drew Washer from French Hospital, Liz Johnson from Twin Cities. We've been working very closely with Community Health Center. I know this can be done in our community, you know, and just one hospice bed would make a huge difference. But we need to have a facility. When we build the new shelter, our new one-stop center, I am hoping to include this model on our grand plan, because it would be more convenient to get meals than, you know, running all over. That's part of my problem. If I motel someone that's really ill, then we have the, ooh, how are we going to get food to them? And I have case managers running around at 8 o'clock at night delivering meals. You know, it's not the most cost-effective thing anyone can do with their staff. So it'd be really fabulous to have a place where you can get meals for people. You can make sure that home health can get to them, that they're able to take a shower or a bath, get their feet up, get their infusion therapy if that's what they need, and really provide that extra care and really look at our healthcare dollars and be more efficient in the way that we use them, because prevention is what worth a pound of cure or more. Are there any other questions?
Commissioner Shimousis?
Yes, I'd like to know if you have any way of tracking data or statistics on the number of medically fragile homeless. Is there any way you have of tracking
these
folks?
Yes, we are. All of the agencies are tracking monthly. Transitional Food and Shelter tracks, obviously, so we have their data. And we have our data. Prado just was given a little pool of money for people that only use the Prado Day Center if they're quite ill. And they'll be tracking their dollars as well that they're spending for motel rooms. And we're doing data collection so we know the basic demographics, if it's male, female, the age, the diagnosis, if someone wants to share that with us because of HIPAA laws. We do need to ask people to get a doctor's letter, and then we have the confidentiality that goes with all of that, so we need to be very, very careful with people's health information, but we are tracking.
Does that include what I believe it was last month the Adult Services Policy Council was discussing, case management and tracking the emergency room costs that would be saved by having such a facility?
Mm-hmm. We're all working together because we all know that in the end it will be cost effective. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Warren.
Thanks, Jody, for bringing this to our attention. You know how I feel around this, because we've been looking at it for a long time, and I just don't think it gets the media attention that it should. And I'd like to ask you, for one thing, to send your minutes and agendas to the commission members. I get them on a regular basis, and I'm unable to attend the meetings, but I learn a lot, and I stay abreast of all that you guys are doing, and I find those very, very helpful. And I think that's a good piece for you guys to do, to get those out in the way of some media. And for the other media suggestion I have is, find out who helped them put that state-of-the-art animal shelter together. You know, if our county can do that, why can't we put a shelter together for our people?
You know, and I never want to bring that up in public, but our homeless animals, oftentimes, if they're injured because they're cute and they're fuzzy and they're loving and they have those wonderful little eyes to look into, they get immediate care. And it can be very, very difficult with a homeless person who is not warm and cuddly. But, you know, we're all human beings, and we all have the same rights.
Yes, we do. And you know, there was so much county input, and everybody jumped on that bandwagon. And I think we need to think that piece differently. There was a lot of private money. Besides, I'm glad to hear that you guys are looking at other federal money and CDBG money, and there's a lot of different kind of federal funds out there that could be funneled differently. I've seen them used in some pretty strange ways in this county, and I think that it's time we begin to focus them where we have real need, something that's been here for a long time, and it's just time. And I appreciate it. But and I really want you to check with those, whoever did that, and see if they'll, whoever did their marketing, because they got a lot of private donations, and that was done in a short period of time.
I know. Thank you, Sue.
Are there any other, Commissioner Donnelly?
So my question is, at what stage, and it sounds like you've been in talks, it sounds like, for a while with this, but at what stage in the process really are you, and what is it that we as a commission can do now to help you to push this along further and hopefully make it happen?
Okay, well, the stage of drawing all of our community partners together, we have most of our key players are together through the Homeless Services Coordinating Council. We do have a group that meets, and we have a steering committee that meets, and we deal with all of the homeless issues. So we do have that structure in place. We have a subcommittee, which is the medically fragile, and we've been meeting. But it's really hard when there's not a lot of dollars to work with. And all of us are scrambling for dollars for our different nonprofits. It's very competitive, you know, and fierce out there. But this issue needs to be part of the design of the new shelter. And at this moment in time, we will be launching our new site search in San Luis Obispo. We're going to be having community meetings and calling upon the community to please help and come and give us input on what you'd like to see. For the shelter, we're looking at a one-stop, which is what it says, a one-stop. An emergency night shelter, a respite for medically fragile. I would love to see a job training program. I'd like to see a learning lab during the day for adults and a place for children to study at night on the site. Eventually, maybe moving the Prado Day Center onto the same site so we can do the meal service and have the medical services all in one place. So that is the grand plan, and we will be launching that on July 1st. And that will be the new site search for the One Stop and our community meetings to help us design this new wonderful program that EOC is rolling out. But we can't do it without our partners. So that's what we're hoping the community and our community partners will all come together and work with us on this.
Commissioner Warren.
Yeah, one idea along that with some of the other projects I've worked on that I think it's really important when you're working with a lot of partners, whether they're nonprofits and agencies or whoever, when you bring them to the table, is to make sure we leave our agendas at the door and our worries about our organization so that when we come to that table, we're there with the people that we need to serve, the people that have no advocates, the people that are there, and how do we solve that problem for them? And, you know, and everybody be willing to think out of that box and put what they need to toward that. And it might mean that maybe we're going to have to cut some other small service within our personal organization to contribute to the whole. But like you said, the whole piece is going to save everybody money in the long run and, you know, and give us a sense of responsibility for those less fortunate than ourselves. And but that's, it's a piece that works.
Collaboration is a wonderful thing. And I also have, besides looking at the RASPET model in Bakersfield, I've been touring emergency shelters throughout California and looking at their facilities and talking to their directors to find out how they came up with what they have. And every shelter and every service group has their own story. And the different shelters are driven by the community need and the partners. And we all share the same clients, and we need to keep our focus on what our clients need and how best we can serve them and what best practices are all about. Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much. Now the public has an opportunity to ask questions or make a comment. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to say something at this point in time? Okay. Then thank you both very much for being here, and we appreciate your work. We'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the Public Health Department report. I believe Mr. Hamm is going to be giving that tonight.
I'm going to stand up here if that's all right. Good evening. Dr. Thomas wasn't feeling very well this afternoon and asked me to stand in for him. On his way out the door, he wanted me to let you know, or he asked me to let you know that he had a question about suicide rate, I guess, last month. He was going to respond back. I'm not sure where he got the data, but he indicated that 9% of the suicides in the county for the period of time that he was looking at were associated with either ASH or CMC. So there was some question about whether that was a significant percentage and the effect that that had on our data. He was actually surprised that it was that low. So, and if you'll allow me real quickly, I want to introduce Jeff O'Quest. He didn't step up during the public comment period, but he's the newest member of the County Administrative Office and has been, fortunately, he's been assigned to the Health and Human Services budget. So we got the new guy, and he is going to be working with us over, well, probably some number of years on the development of the annual budget, and as well as he's our liaison for everything else that we work with the County Administrative Office on every week. So he wanted to be here and get to know the commission. I thought I'd introduce him.
Welcome. Thank you very much for coming.
It's late, and the topics that I was going to throw out onto the table for discussion and see if you had any questions about are fairly complex. So I'm just going to list them and see if you what you find interesting and if you have any questions. There's been some recent press. Whoops, Sarah just left. Sarah's done a good job of covering the national class action lawsuit that we have been involved in with six other counties where we're pursuing a lawsuit against the federal government for our low rate of Medicare reimbursement. Just wanted to make sure that you were aware that that was happening. Don't have any other information really about it to share with you, but just wanted to bring that to your attention. Budget status. A week from today, the county begins its budget hearing process. We are up first after the county administrator's overview. So anyone who wants to come and participate in the section of the county's budget hearings that deal with the health agency's budget should be there bright and early Monday at 9 a.m. when the hearings begin, a week from today, June 18th. There's been some coverage of the fact that the health agency's is the amount of general fund support that we're getting for next year is up a tremendous amount. I don't know if tremendous is the word they used, but a significant amount. 56% up from about $8 million to about $13 million. The county administrator has publicly indicated to the board and anyone watching their meetings that that's a level of general fund support that the county is unlikely to be able to sustain long term. So I'm meeting tomorrow, in fact, to discuss our preliminary, very preliminary assessment of what we might be looking at a year from now, going into 08-09, and what we're going to do about it. So while we continue to hear lots of extraordinarily compelling arguments for increased funding for a whole long list of things, ocean water monitoring, hospice, respite beds, we are facing the loss of $1.2 million in the state budget for next year for our homeless outreach program for mentally ill. We refer to it as HOP. The governor cut funding for it in his January budget. We thought it was such a silly proposal that we were sure he was going to come to his senses and restore funding in the May revise, and he didn't. And now it's something that's getting debated in the legislature, in the Joint Budget Conference Committee. But it means $920,000 to us for our mental health programs for homeless, mentally ill homeless. And the smart money indicates that, or believes that, even if the legislature restores funding, the governor is going to line item veto it. So this year, 07-08, has been a fairly easy one for the health agency in terms of budget development. We didn't have to go through a cut list. We developed one, but we didn't. It wasn't the basis of the CAO's recommended budget. But we're already beginning to talk about what's going to happen for the 08-09 budget, and there are lots of counties in California that are right now experiencing tremendous reductions in services that they're able to provide through their mental health and public health departments. So it's in terms of the budget roller coaster that I had hoped a year ago when I came back to the health agency, I was somehow going to be able to find a way to help us avoid going through that dramatic annual experience of worrying about, you know, the extent to which we were going to have to make service level reductions in core programs. We got a one-year reprieve, but next year is not going to be as easy.
Does that impact our PUF unit at all?
Well, it's more the other way around, I think. The psychiatric inpatient facility is a big draw of increased amounts of general fund support. So there's a reason that our general fund contribution for essentially a status quo budget is going from 8 to 13 million. There's lots of reasons, but the fact that the inpatient psych unit costs what it costs is a big part of that.
But aren't we mandated to have that facility or no?
Counties have closed them. So you're not legally obligated to have one. It's not as much a legal obligation as it is a community obligation.
Moral obligation, maybe?
I'll use community. And I thought I'd touch on detox very, very quickly. That also got quite a bit of attention in the media over the past, I don't know, couple months. Board of Supervisors had a strategic planning session not too long ago, and that issue sort of raised up in their strategic thought process. I think it's fair to say that what they really wanted to know, and much like the previous speaker, there are some things that make much more sense. You can spend your money on prevention and intervention, and we know that it costs less to have someone in a residential detox program than it costs to have them in jail. So a couple of board members said, you know, Jeff, why don't we have one? If it costs less, you know, shouldn't we have one? And they directed us to basically provide them with an analysis of the financial and operational implications of having one or not having one in this community. We're still working on that, but the preliminary indication is that while it saves society $4, $7, or $12, depending on what you include in the formula, for every dollar that you spend on something like a social model, non-medical residential detox facility, the money is savings in the criminal justice system, broadly defined, in the hospital emergency rooms, in the sheriff's jail operating budget, in the probation department. And it really isn't savings in the sense that the sheriff and the hospitals and the probation department and the Superior Court can write us a check so that we can develop a residential detox program. It doesn't work like that. We're talking really about longer-term cost avoidance, cost increase reductions, or sort of, you know, savings in that. You know, there's 550 people in jail on any given day. If a detox facility in the community could reduce the jail population on any given day from 550 to 547, is that going to reduce the sheriff's operating budget? You know, no, very, very little. The cost of a couple meals. It doesn't work that way. So we're briefing members of the Board of Supervisors on our preliminary results, and in the meantime, Star Graber, the director of our Drug and Alcohol Services Division, Behavioral Health Department, is working with all the folks in the community, as she continues to try and find a way to identify some capacity, maybe to reallocate some resources to work with the folks who are trying to build capacity in the organization, to see if we can't put something together that isn't going to require county money, because the prospects of getting $150,000 or $200,000 a year, which is our preliminary estimates of what it would probably take to get something like that up and running right now, is just money that we don't have. So, healthcare reform is a really complicated mess. I'm not going to spend any time on it given where we are in your meeting. Unless you have any specific questions, there's been a lot of coverage. The governor's proposal is a very, very sweeping, comprehensive thing, and there isn't a bill. There's nothing in writing. There's no language. We know that it takes back, essentially from the counties, most of our medically indigent adult responsibilities and a lot of money. Preliminary figures for this county are about $5 million. But it's also very, very unlikely that the governor's proposal is going to get much serious play. Ledge Council just released an opinion indicating that the fees that the governor wanted to charge physicians and hospitals and other providers are really taxes, which would require two-thirds approval in the legislature, et cetera, et cetera. There's a couple proposals put forward by Assemblyman Parada and Senator Nunez, the Assembly Speaker and the President Pro Tem of the Senate, that are also getting a lot of play, AB 8 and SB 48. Those just moved out of their houses of origin this week into the other house, so that means they're going to continue to be debated. And we're paying a lot of attention. There's folks in Sacramento who are spending all of their time trying to figure out what these things mean for their various constituencies. Even if there is a legislative proposal that makes it through the process and the governor signs, and it's going to get challenged in court on a whole bunch of different aspects, and the legislative staff from those two offices have been indicating to CHEAC and CSAC, our folks up in Sacramento, that it's unlikely that those things would actually result in any changes in the way the healthcare financing system works in California for several years at best. So that's my update. Any questions?
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I'd like to ask that next year when they do the annual report on the health report, if we could have that suicide rate broken down. They did that for us with the HIV numbers, that they were inclusive of CMC and ASH,
okay.
And they broke them out. And that was very helpful.
Any other questions from commissioners? Thank you very much, Mr. Hamm. We appreciate that interesting report. We'll move on to the next item on the agenda, which are the Health Commission updates, first being the chair update. I did attend the SART meeting last week, and they are hoping to move into their new quarters in the former General Hospital emergency room and area. I think it's going to be September now, I think is what they're looking at. They are the subcommittee for drug endangered children has yet to meet, and the drug facilitated as sexual assaults, there are notices to the ERs to be alert for these, because the drug does clear so quickly, and hospitals are being encouraged to to help with identifying that. And they are continuing to assemble bilingual volunteer panel. And I think that's about it for SART. The Tobacco Coalition did not have a meeting this past month. They are having one next week. But I did want to say about the Tobacco Coalition, you know, I think I reported that we had submitted our work plan, and we were among the we received kudos from the state for presenting such a good plan, and Susan and her staff really are to be commended for the work that they've done there. And then there are a number of tobacco-related bills coming out of either house in the state house, but I don't think I need to go into that unless you're interested to know which ones they are. And let's see, the Obesity Task Force will be meeting this. We're having like a reunion meeting and now going to actually move ahead on the on implementing the plan, and that meeting will be later this week. I think that's it for my update. So we'll start on my left, and I will ask if Commissioner Tilscher has a report.
No report.
Commissioner Hetherington.
I attended the Domestic Violence Task Force, and they did a short update. It was a short meeting because they had a memorial for fallen officers, so we were there a very short time. But the program from the women's shelter is going forward as far as educating all of the law enforcement officers on recognizing domestic violence, and I think it would be a grand thing to have them come and present to the Health Commission, because they're a model program. They have people coming and looking at what they're doing, how successful it is, how the law enforcement community has bought in and has actually changed some of their reporting factors from this educational endeavor. So I would like to suggest that we agendize them in the near future.
Commissioner Garena?
No report.
Commissioner Simousis?
I attended the Adult Services Policy Council meeting, and Grace McIntosh, who's the executive director of the local chapter of the American Red Cross, presented information regarding VODE, that's Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, producing a grid that, it's a resource grid that identifies voluntary organizations' missions and objectives, human and material resources, and a 24-hour contact list that describes what these organizations can provide in a disaster and who the contact person is. It was actually quite helpful and very interesting. And also, I'm kind of wondering, Larry Bacchus from the CHC attends this meeting and always gives an update, and I think it would be interesting for the commissioners to hear what's going on with CHC, as they're doing a lot of moving and expanding and adding providers and services. They currently have a mobile medical clinic in San Miguel. It's operational 3 days a week. One of those days is open after 5 p.m., and they're also looking to take the mobile clinic to other locations and looking for land in San Miguel to build a clinic and consolidate the dental services from Paso Robles Templeton and Templeton in the future. A lot of stuff going on in that council. So that's it.
Thank you. Commissioner Hicks?
No report.
Commissioner Massey? Commissioner Horn?
Yes, I went to a Children's Services Network, and Children's Services Network is in the process of redesigning itself. And that will be probably, there will not be any meetings for the next 2 months. And then they will come up. I have a proposal that they passed out at the meeting. They are really, they saw people not coming to the meetings. It was just kind of falling apart. And so they felt that the coming together of all of these different organizations that provide services for children needed to have a different structure to it. And so that's the process that they are beginning. And should be interesting when they get finished with it. And hopefully there won't be overlapping so that you're using your funds in a way that is most efficient and you're providing services better than they are currently providing them.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I am. Attended the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board meeting, and this month it was a joint meeting with both behavioral health boards, with mental health and drug and alcohol. We had the drug and alcohol meeting first, and then they had a period of time where both groups came together and had a chance to meet and talk about common issues and really get to find out what they're both doing. And some of them attended the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board meeting, and then a number of folks stayed and went to the Mental Health Board meeting. I was extremely impressed with the direction that the Mental Health Board is taking. They really have gotten to the point where they've done a lot of training, and they've got some committees, and they're really looking specifically at programs and seeing how well they work, what works best, what could be improved, this kind of thing. So I look forward to discussion this next month with the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board and what everybody else's take was on it. But I was impressed rather than at Drug and Alcohol. We're just kind of, they work on policy statements and kind of issues that pop up. And there's just a real difference in the direction and programs, at the projects that they're doing.
Commissioner Donnelly?
No report.
Okay, that's the end of the commissioner report, so we'll move on to the committees. Legislative Committee, Commissioner Shimousis?
Yes, the Legislative Committee did not have a quorum at our last meeting, and so I did have an opportunity to discuss process, which is something that the Legislative Committee hasn't really done in detail. And from that discussion with Marcia, I've developed a plan of action for next year to address a timeline that we need to adhere to in order to get our input to the legislator in a timely manner. I did pass out to all of the commissioners California bills of interest, so you have an idea of what we're looking at, how we look at it, the kinds of information that we review in order to determine what bills are most appropriate to either support, not support, or do more research on, and then determine from there. And I will be asking the commissioners to study this prior to the meeting in March so that I can get some action for the Legislative Committee in a timely manner to Mr. Hamm so that he can review it and get our input to our lobbyists in time for the May session to have our input on the bills before they move out of houses. Okay, so.
And I understand the committee is going to meet with Mr. Hamm at the end of July.
July 24th, yes.
Get further instruction how to do this effectively. That's great. Thank you very much, Jeff, for being willing to do that. Okay, and so there is no action from the Legislative Committee?
There is no action at this time because the bills have already been voted on and moving along.
And, okay, so now we have Community Education. Commissioner Hetherington?
No report.
Okay. The Budget Committee, Commissioner Tilsher?
No report.
Okay, so then the Nominating Committee, Commissioner Hicks?
Nominating Committee, since all of you were so excited to volunteer to run as an officer, the slate is the same as it was this year. Chairman Enns, myself as Chair Lynn Enns, Vice Chair, myself, Jan Hicks, Secretary Penny Chimousis. That is the recommendation from the Nominating Committee.
I guess this is an action item. Therefore, we need a motion, I believe.
I was going to move, but if...
No, anybody can make the motion.
I move that we accept the recommendations of the Nominating Committee and vote in favor of the three officers so listed.
Okay. I think you can only move that we accept the you know, the voting comes after that. Isn't that correct? Yeah. Yeah. That. Okay. So.
Oh, so. You, okay.
Yeah.
For the acceptance and then the voting.
Right. So, is there a second to that motion? Okay. It's been moved and seconded that the commission accept the recommendations of the nominating committee. And there is a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion? Okay. There's no discussion. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just wondering if all the, I know I received an email, and I was wondering if all the commissioners had an opportunity to give their feedback to the nominating committee. Because it's usually earlier. I think we usually do it at our July meeting, don't we? At our
no,
retreat?
We do it in June to be set for July because it has to go to the board. And each member of the commission did get an email requesting, first of all, whether or not they would like to be part of the executive committee, interest in being part of the executive committee. And they had a choice to respond to myself or Jean, and neither one of us had any responses. So I called all of you that I could get a hold of, and I got the same response. So that's how I can answer your question, Commissioner Chamusis.
So you're probably stuck with the job, my dear. So there is a motion on the floor. Discussion is now closed. And therefore, we will now call for the vote. Do we need to do do we have to do a roll call vote on this? Or can we just do a voice? Okay. Let's do a voice vote on this then. All those in favor of accepting the slate of that the nominating committee has put forth, please indicate your indicate. All those who say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? One opposed. Any abstentions?
I abstain.
Okay. Then it has, the motion has passed with one oppose and one abstention. And that's that. Okay. So, moving forward to prospective future items, we will have our next meeting as a workshop like we have done in the past. And so we will not meet here. We will meet, hopefully, somewhere more comfortable. Yeah, at the Ag Auditorium, if we can get that room, that's very convenient. And at that time, we will discuss the programs that we'd like to see for the upcoming year. And I would like to ask everybody to really make a list of things that you're interested in seeing us go forward with. And I think we've made some inroads in public education and in making our programs interesting for the televised public. And I hope that we can continue to do more of that. So if there isn't anything else, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Second. I'm sure there's no objection to that, so this meeting is adjourned.